Welcome, everyone, to Integrating New Advances in the Care of Patients with Cancer, again, a multi-tumor symposium in partnership with the American Oncology Network. Again, our agenda today, we've completed Module 1 with lung cancer. We're starting with Module 2 with chronic lymphocytic leukemia. We're blessed to have faculty, Dr. Rogers, here today from Ohio State University. So Dr. Kerry Rogers is Associate Professor, Division of Hematology at Ohio State, and will be talking to us today about CLL. These are her disclosures. We're going to level set with just some data from the AON practices as a whole. I think from the earlier slides we saw, there were some 1,200-plus patients within the network who'd received some therapy for CLL. This is those who had documented deletion 17 or P53 mutations, and those with IGVH mutations. This is looking at utilization patterns for those patients who received acalabrutinib versus zanubrutinib versus pirtobrutinib, and BCL2-based therapy with venetoclax. There's also a few CAR-T patients. I just actually referred one this week for CAR-T. So without further ado, we'll jump through the data. Dr. Rogers will go through that. Then we'll go through cases and answer questions. So thank you, Dr. Rogers.
Thank you. So I'm really excited to be talking to everyone about chronic lymphocytic leukemia. Also excited to be talking right after lunch, so I have everyone's full attention, and to be in Texas where the weather here is markedly better than central Ohio right now. So I'm Kerry Rogers. I'm an associate professor in the Division of Hematology at The Ohio State University. And I wanted to start out by just talking about what the options are for CLL these days. So there's actually three main regimen types that we use as an initial treatment. The one that's been around the longest is the continuous BTK inhibitors. Then we have the venetoclax obinutuzumab, which was kind of next along. And then more recently, BTK inhibitor venetoclax regimens. So we now have two venetoclax-based kind of fixed duration options and then the continuous BTK inhibitors. So the fixed duration regimens in general limit time on treatment, toxicity, from chronic treatment, cost, but do require venetoclax ramp up and have some drawbacks. So just to get people thinking about what the options are. These are the three approved covalent BTK inhibitors. I'm sure everyone's familiar with these. As people probably know, ibrutinib, the first-in-class drug, is now less preferred due to increased cardiovascular toxicities compared to the other two and decreased selectivity. So it hits more protein kinases, as you can see from that colorful little kinase map on there. However, even though it's less preferred to start now, it is the one we have the longest data with because it's the first-in-class agent. So I'm showing you here some very long-term follow-up data with ibrutinib from RESONATE-2, where the median progression-free survival in this frontline trial was 8.9 years. So that is very long, and I've actually not seen a median PFS for any of the other BTK inhibitors because they just haven't gotten there yet. And also, this is pooled data from ibrutinib trials showing that patients with CLL taking a first-line BTK inhibitor can anticipate a normal survival. So the impact of this class of drug on our patients has been huge. The other two covalent BTK inhibitors, acalabrutinib and zanubrutinib, are also highly effective. The progression-free survival looks that it's going to be similar, if not better, than it is with ibrutinib. We just don't have medians yet because the trials haven't been going on long enough. And I'm showing you 6-year follow-up from ELEVATE-TN, which was a frontline trial, which also had acalabrutinib and obinutuzumab, where you can see that obinutuzumab does look to improve progression-free survival, although the trial was not powered to show that. And that's true in all patients except for those with deletion 17P. There's also 5-year follow-up from the initial studies with zanubrutinib in the frontline setting. This is the Sequoia trial. And I'm showing you arm C here, which was the arm specifically for patients with deletion 17P, showing a very similar progression-free survival to those without. So this is really just demonstrating that this approach of continuous BTK inhibition is very effective. We also have venetoclax obinutuzumab. This does also have a median PFS reported from CLL14, which was in older or less fit individuals, of 6.35 years. This is shorter than what I just showed you with continuous BTK inhibitors, but definitely has the benefit of patients being off treatment for most of that time. This limits side effects, costs, and also development of resistance. So it's an open question whether it's better to do something that's continuous and maximizes your PFS as an initial treatment, but then the CLL is resistant, or to use this strategy where the PFS might be shorter, although still very good. However, retreatment or other kind of limited duration therapies could be used, or continuous BTK inhibitors after that. CLL13 was the same regimen, but in fit patients. This actually had an arm with venetoclax rituximab, which did not perform quite as well. And this data was extrapolated to the relapse refractory setting, which is why you'll see most people use off-label obinutuzumab in relapse refractory CLL other than the approved combination antibody, which is rituximab. I think the biggest thing is really Amplify got reported at ASH last year. This is a randomized phase 3 study of initial treatment in patients without deletion 17p CLL and compares a fixed duration AV or AVO to standard chemoimmunotherapy. Both the AV and the AVO had an improved progression-free survival compared to chemoimmunotherapy, really showing that chemoimmunotherapy is something that we should not be using for our patients. AVO did look to be slightly better, although the study wasn't powered to show that. It also was true that giving a more limited duration of BTK inhibitor, this was 14 cycles here, does limit some of the cardiovascular toxicities that we know to be common with this class of drugs. So that is a good strategy to reduce cardiovascular risk, although infection risk is still quite important. This is the overall survival data from Amplify, where you can see AV really has the best overall survival, although it's not statistically different, you know, potentially from AVO, it is, compared to chemoimmunotherapy. But when you remove or censor COVID-19 deaths, they all come very close together. AVO goes right up there with AV, and both arms where patients received an anti-CD20 had higher number of deaths from COVID. That might not be relevant in terms of mortality in our current age, but I think this does highlight a very real risk of giving patients anti-CD20 monoclonal antibodies that shouldn't be overlooked. There are, of course, zanubrutinib studies with these combinations as well. This is Sequoia, which is zanubrutinib venetoclax. This was an arm of Sequoia that was added for deletion 17p and then accrued non-17p patients for comparison and had a complex MRD and response-guided stopping rule. So in this study, it looks like patients with and without 17p CLL or deletion 17p CLL did similarly. However, less than 10% of patients were able to stop treatment, and this is really more of a continuous strategy at this follow-up duration. There is Bovin, which is a triple therapy with zanubrutinib and venetoclax, again with complex MRD-guided stopping rules. More patients in this study were able to stop treatment, and you did get deep remissions, but I don't think this strategy is currently ready for standard use. What will hopefully be ready for standard use is zanubrutinib and sonrotoclax. So sonrotoclax is a novel BCL-2 inhibitor that also has activity against BCL-xL, which hopefully improves the efficacy. It was combined with zanubrutinib in a very successful phase 1 study and was put into phase 3 testing compared to venetoclax and obinutuzumab. So I think this is going to be a really exciting trial. It's called Celestial and promises to potentially establish zanubrutinib and sonrotoclax as a standard regimen. The study is fully accrued, so hopefully we'll get results at some point. Maybe not too soon because we want the patients to do well. And then I think I'd be remiss if I didn't cover pirtobrutinib. So this is shifting a little bit to data with kind of the other end of the spectrum. So these are CLL patients who have received mostly both a BTK inhibitor and a BCL-2 inhibitor. Some have CLL that's even resistant to both. And the comparison here was idelalisib, rituximab, or BR, which you're thinking that doesn't seem like a standard, but really in this space, nothing else really fits as a standard. The progression-free survival was improved with pirtobrutinib, but still was relatively short at a median of 14 months. And I think this is the best PFS we really see in this patient population and just reflects that this is where the unmet need is in CLL these days, this group. The safety data was very favorable with kind of lower rates of atrial fibrillation and hypertension than you'd see with some of the bigger covalent BTK inhibitor studies, although I'll also point out that patients were really on treatment about 1 to 2 years, so you don't see the same cumulative incidence over time because the treatment duration was by nature shorter. I'm really looking forward to two phase three studies that have data now with pirtobrutinib as an initial treatment. One was a specific study of pirtobrutinib versus BR as an initial treatment for CLL. The other was pirtobrutinib versus ibrutinib, where a subset were initial treatment patients. The BRUIN 314, which is pirtobrutinib versus ibrutinib, will be reported at ASH. I summarized some of the data from the abstract here for us. And this is a randomized comparison of ibrutinib to pirtobrutinib, where you have about a third of the patients taking this as a first treatment. The primary endpoint was overall response rate, which was in fact higher with pirto. And you can see the 18th-month progression-free survival is numerically higher too, with lower rates of AFib and hypertension, just as I've described. So I think additional follow-up of the study will be interesting, and I really look forward to the full reporting at ASH. The BRUIN 313 study, which is the pirto versus BR strictly in previously untreated patients, does not have any data that's public yet other than the press release from the company saying that it had a statistically significant improvement in progression-free survival. So I really look forward to seeing that too once it's available. And then lastly, I just wanted, I know there was a lot of data in a few minutes, but I think I'd be remiss if I didn't cover BTK degraders because I think this is a really exciting mechanism for targeting BTK. So we so far have been very successful with our kinase inhibitors and then, you know, newer BTK kinase inhibitors that target mutant BTK or target in different ways or better. But this actually binds BTK and uses the cell protein degradation machinery to just remove BTK. And it is effective even when there's BTK mutations, which are a major resistance mechanism in CLL. This is just data with one of these agents, BGB-16673, which is a BTK degrader. And you can see this is quite effective in a very difficult to treat or kind of heavily pretreated patient population. So I think at some point these drugs will become standard, and I look forward to seeing what they can do for our CLL patients. So I think I'll end there.
Excellent. Thank you so much. We're going to move into a few case presentations at this point, and we'll start off with Dr. Lamar.
Our next module on chronic lymphocytic leukemia begins with a case from Dr. Lamar and a common situation in first-line treatment of older patients.
I have a 75-year-old gentleman with a history of atrial fibrillation on anticoagulation, who was diagnosed with CLL and was symptomatic because of anemia and thrombocytopenia. He was started on zanubrutinib and responded well to therapy, but had significant bruising and just really didn't like it. We actually dropped him from full dose of the apixaban to half of the dose, and the bleeding reduced. However, the cardiologist was concerned about that dose reduction. And I'm curious, how do you all approach anticoagulation in patients who are at very high risk for stroke? Which wins? The conversation I had with the cardiologist is like, hey, can we do a procedure to essentially get this person off anticoagulation? And the cardiologist says, hey, don't we have other treatments for CLL? Do you ever consider potentially treating those patients with pirtobrutinib, or are you expecting the same toxicity profile?
Any other questions about this case?
a lot of patients are very interested in time-limited therapies. And so in those patients, are you all routinely looking at MRD?
So I see you're a co-author on the AMPLIFY study of acalabrutinib and venetoclax with or without obinutuzumab. Any questions about that for Dr. Rogers?
I'm a big proponent of limited duration treatment. The AMPLIFY regimen is on NCCN now, but I don't think it's FDA approved yet. I'd like to know what she's doing right now while we are waiting for approvals on the AMPLIFY side and how she selects her patients. How does she approach a patient who's youngish or young, 40-ish? Is there any role for FCR? And when does she even bring up the topic of allogeneic transplantation in 2025?
Okay, a lot to unpack question-wise there. But we'll start off with healthy patient, no high-risk features, IGVH mutated CLL with no 17p deletion. What are your thoughts in initial frontline therapy today?
I think that's an outstanding question. So I usually consider the CLL biology patient comorbidities and preferences. And here it sounds like comorbidities and preferences don't really have any strong pull, at least from what's provided. For IGHB mutated CLL without deletion 17P or TP53 mutations, you see an extremely good progression-free survival with both the fixed-duration venetoclax combinations, ven-obin or BTK inhibitor venetoclax. So for patients with IGHB mutated CLL, unless there's a reason not to, I usually recommend a fixed-duration venetoclax-based combination.
Would the presence or absence of a 13q deletion, if you had that knowledge, change your decision in any way?
Not really, because I think that those similarly fall in the really good risk category. I think if they had deletion 17p, that would definitely factor into my decision or make the discussion more complicated. So,
for those patients that you're thinking about beginning with a BTK inhibitor, who choose perhaps not to do fixed duration therapy, what's your preferred BTK in this space, understanding the challenges or side effects of both?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I have really used either acalabrutinib or zanubrutinib. I've used them both. I think that zanubrutinib has that nice daily dosing scheme, unlike the BID with ACAL, which matters a great deal to a particular subset of patients, also has more flexibility with dose adjustment. The ACAL really, if you look at the hypertension data, I think might be a little better. So for people with a lot of cardiovascular risk, sometimes I do that, but I use both of those. And actually, insurance has decided for me a few times. And I think between those two options, I have no problem if the insurance prefers one or the other.
What if insurance were to suggest ibrutinib in this space post-IRA?
So if insurance actually had prescribed zanubrutinib once and they said you can have acalabrutinib, ibrutinib, or pertubrutinib, and I found that very confusing because it was a frontline patient. If ibrutinib were kind of required by the insurance company, I would probably appeal that based on the cardiovascular risk.
Perfect. Thank you. All right. If a patient with CLL, we know bruising can be significant, and I know everyone's seen that. So if they're having significant bruising or bleeding related to the BTKI, what are your thoughts on pertubrutinib in that setting, or is there a dose reduction, a solution that you would recommend?
Yeah, I think the bruising is really hard because it doesn't always get better with dose reduction. And it seems to be some people have a lot of it, some people have none. Pertubrutinib, just in my experience, seems to have less bruising, but it's not zero. So if someone had life-threatening bleeding, I would not give them pertubrutinib. I also worry that we don't know if you can use covalent BTK inhibitors after pertubrutinib. So for a young patient with several decades of lifespan, I would not switch to that as a frontline option. For someone who's older, where they're probably going to get one or two treatments in their natural lifespan, I do think that would be reasonable to try.
I know you showed some slides with respect to MRD testing and what its role might be in this disease space. How are you using MRD in your practice in addition to lab and routine scanning to determine when you may or may offer a patient a treatment holiday or discontinuation in the BTK space?
Yeah, that's also a very important question. I use MRD quite a bit in research studies, but don't use it a lot in like routine clinical practice. It seems with continuous BTK inhibitors, the longer people take them, the longer the remission will be when you stop them. So stopping within the first 6 months doesn't work very well. Stopping within 2 years, the median to needing treatment again is 2 years. But I've had people that have stopped 7, 8, or 9 years. And I used to do MRD testing to say, okay, if we can't detect leukemia, then it would be more reasonable to stop it. But I have seen some people who needed to stop at 8 or 9 years due to side effects or some other health condition, and they actually stayed in remission a good long time. So I think that's just one factor to look at along with the others when you're having that discussion.
Okay, for point of clarity, when we say MRD in that situation, are you considering peripheral blood flow cytometry, attended the minus fourth MRD testing? Are we talking clonoSEQ? What's your...
Oh, that's also a good question. In general, I've used peripheral blood flow cytometry because it's easier to do, although I have used clonoSEQ in research studies, and I've actually started using that if patients really want MRD testing with the venetoclax fixed duration combinations.
And then one more follow-up. So as you serially follow these patients, how frequently do you repeat FISH testing, et cetera, to see for any evolution in a 17P clone?
So at time of relapse and then at time of needing a next treatment. So before each treatment, I do that because knowing that information will help select the next treatment.
Perfect. Next case from Dr. Mulhern.
The next case from Dr. Mulhern is an 82-year-old patient with high-risk disease.
This gentleman had worsening symptomatic lymphadenopathy, lymphocytosis. He has a white count of 41. He has generalized lymph nodes, particularly symptomatic from a right supraclavicular node. He does have a P53 mutation. He's IGVH unmutated. And he's 82, but he golfs every day if he can. He's very interested in something that will limit his exposure and look at, you know, time-limited therapy. So what's the optimal treatment for him? Would you consider doing something like venobin in a patient with a P53 mutation with this higher risk disease? What about assuming that we have acala obinutuzumab available, or eventually pirto? And then let's say he goes on acalabrutinib or zanubrutinib, you know, just by itself. Do you really want to keep him on this, you know, forever? Would you consider using MRD in addition to routine scans and labs to determine the length of therapy? He's 82, but he's a really good 82. You know, he's in fitness classes and all this stuff. So this is unusually, you know, kind of fit.
Okay. In general, what is your preferred initial treatment, Dr. Rogers, for an otherwise healthy patient with an unmutated IGVH with no deletion 17P? And, you know, as Dr. Mulhern brought up, is how much does age factor into that and the natural longevity there?
Yeah, I think this is the group of CLL patients where really all the options are pretty open. So I have some patients that really want to maximize their benefit from first-line therapy and just want to take the BTK inhibitor continuously. And actually, some people pick that due to convenience, like this patient who I think was 82 golfs all the time, and some of those patients don't want to come in for any of the venetoclax hassle. I have used AV as a standard of care since it's in the NCCN guidelines, so sometimes, you know, I can convince some people to come in and do the ven, even though they weren't willing to take the time to do the ven open. But I think lifestyle factors, comorbidities, other things actually have more weight than the disease biology for this group for me. I think age matters a little bit, but for fit patients, kind of all the options are still there. You're probably looking at this person having 10 to 15 years of lifespan rather than 40. So when you're thinking about sequencing of treatments across someone's lifespan, the 40-year outlook is not quite as good. And I've said that to some people in their 80s, and they thought that was hilarious, that their 40-year outlook was bad. So I think that matters a little bit about age. But all these drugs have been studied in an older and less fit population.
I know you presented a number of slides looking at three drug regimens, and we've got a question coming, but is there a place where you would consider a triple drug in the frontline setting?
Yes, definitely. So we have used IVO. We have a study with that. So we've had it investigationally for years. I think that the three drug regimens are quite good. They are tolerable, especially when you look at some of the stuff we've treated people with in other cancers. So I think that the anti-CD20 adds some infection risk and certainly a hassle factor. So you want to select patients where that's going to be worth it over just AV. The patients were, I didn't actually say this in the presentation, but for patients with IgHV mutated CLL, they do so well, the OBIN actually doesn't help. So you want to make sure you're using that in someone where you know they're going to have a benefit. And then especially younger patients that don't have deletion 17p CLL, they're probably going to be around long enough to realize this, you know, potential emerging PFS benefit. So I think I would try to convince someone who's younger and has more lifespan or would experience more treatments over the lifespan that it's worth it to come for the infusions. And then my personal concern about people, you know, ending up hospitalized from viral infections is lower in the younger population. So younger being probably 65 and under-ish.
You get younger as we get older, right?
Right.
Okay, so in general, what would your preferred treatment be for those 17p deleted patients, understanding, you know, the poor prognosis there?
Oh, yeah. So, you know, the best PFS in the frontline setting with deletion 17p CLL is with continuous BTK inhibitors. That is very clear. And so anything that is a fixed duration, time-limited strategy, you see that the people with deletion 17p CLL do not have as long of a progression-free survival. So I always talk to people with deletion 17p CLL about maximizing their benefit from initial therapy in terms of PFS. Many of them do want to do BTK inhibitors for that reason, although I certainly have treated patients who really wanted a fixed duration treatment with venetoclax-based regimens, and I don't think that's wrong. I've also had some patients where AFib was destroying their life. I'm sure we've all met those people, like the AFib's worse than the leukemia. And then certainly I would treat them with a venetoclax-based regimen. I haven't done this yet myself, but there's some data that Dr. David's published on AVO as an MRD-guided approach, so I think that would be attractive for a younger patient that was really deeply interested in having fixed-duration therapy with deletion 17p, but I would not consider that really a standard yet.
Perfect. That was really helpful. I think, you know, you have a few variables when you talk about, you know, P17 status, IGVH mutation status, age of the patient, trying to think through, or thanks for lending a machete to our mental thicket about how to provide guidance for the patients there.
Yeah.
So for someone, again, CLL, who's interested in a time-limited therapy, what are your thoughts about venobina versus acalabrutinib?
Yeah, so since it's in the NCCN guidelines, I certainly have used acalabrutinib venetoclax as a standard regimen. I think if it's in the NCCN, I consider it standard, and I've not had difficulty with insurance coverage for it. So I do consider this something that I just use for the patients. Some of the deciding factors have been whether or not I think a BTK inhibitor is going to be an issue. Or if I have someone that's really not going to want to come for the infusions and cope with obinutuzumab well. And that usually kind of decides it. Mostly I'm trying to convince someone to do a fixed duration therapy and like, I don't want to come for 8 weeks in a row and do all this with venobin. I'm like, okay, but could we get you to do AV? And they're like, okay, maybe I could do that. So I think the presence of the BTK inhibitor and the administration schedule really make the biggest difference.
And when you do acalabrutinib, how are you, all things considered, getting the drugs appropriately and timeliness, but on your ramp up and starting acalabrutinib?
Yeah, so the Amplify had two cycles of 28 days, so basically 2 months of acala and then the ven, and then like the 12 months of the combination. So I've tried to stick with that, but it's always nice if you have someone not participating in a trial to have some flexibility. I had someone that started with highly symptomatic CLL, that the disease was decreasing, and he finally, you know, got himself back out of feeling terrible. So I'm like, why don't we wait another month before doing ven? So I certainly haven't delayed ven like really long term. I've tried to do about 2 months of acala and then done the ven.
And do you have concerns about initial leukocytosis or lymphocytosis when you start the acala, and then concerns about TLS with ven in that space, or does your white count usually come back down in the Amplify trial by then that you feel comfortable?
Yeah, so usually the disease burden decreased enough that people weren't high risk or needed to be hospitalized, but I have had a few patients that even though they did 2 months of ACAL, still had to be monitored inpatient for the ven, but it worked out just fine for them.
Perfect. Okay, off the record, would you ever be comfortable using Xanax in the place of a Cala in combination with Vin?
Yes, I don't think that that is something that is so different that I would be uncomfortable with it. And there's certainly enough data with a combination in clinical trials to know that the safety is there. I think the main reason to not do that is usually if I'm treating someone as a standard of care, I usually stick to either approved regimens or something in the NCCN. But if I had a patient that, for whatever reason, really couldn't tolerate ACAL but was doing a combination, I would not have a problem if I needed to use zanubrutinib there.
Perfect. Wonderful. Next case. Let's see. We got one more question. Based on the emerging results from the Bruin trials, the CLL-313 and 314, when and how might you choose to use Pirto in that frontline setting?
I think this is a really interesting question and a difficult one. So I think we're going to see, and what I was showing you from the data available in the ASH abstract, is that pirtobrutinib is going to be more effective than ibrutinib in a frontline setting. The issue arises, pirtobrutinib was designed to target BTK with a C481S mutant, which is a resistance mutation. The resistance mutations we've seen with pirtobrutinib are largely those that are also resistance mechanisms for the covalent BTK inhibitors, like a T474I mutation. Granted, patients taking pirtobrutinib mostly have gotten the covalent ones first, so that could play a role. But we don't know if you give someone pirtobrutinib first, if you can give them ibrutinib, zanubrutinib, or acalabrutinib after. So you might make it so that their total benefit from BTK inhibitor monotherapy is shorter if you do pirtobrutinib first. We don't know that. So for younger, fit patients, you know, people who you think they've got, you know, 20 or 40 years of lifespan, I probably would not do this without a very good reason, because I worry about the long-term outlook. However, we've all got patients with intermediate or low-risk CLL who are in their 80s that are probably not going to experience more than two treatments before they complete their lifespan, you know, die of something else, and venetoclax certainly would work. So I do think that using pirtobrutinib as a first treatment for patients where you don't think they're going to need to use a different BTK inhibitor after, and you could still use venetoclax, is a great strategy. In fact, we have an investigator-initiated trial looking at first-line pirtobrutinib in older, less fit patients that has kind of limited monitoring and stuff. But we're trying to select for people that aren't going to need 40 years of targeted drugs there because that resistance piece is unknown.
Interesting. You know, I think paralleling the lung space with osimertinib and seeing it, you know, leapfrog second, first and second generation TKIs, and so maybe because of loss of benefit in the sequencing, that wouldn't be wise with Pirto in this space.
That's a great way to say it. Yep.
Perfect. Okay. Next case. Dr. Warsh.
The next case, presented by Dr. Warsh, is an 84-year-old woman with CLL who, after an observation period, was noted to have thrombocytopenia, neutropenia, and progressive lymphadenopathy on imaging. She then responded to ibrutinib, but treatment was held due to cardiac complications. She was observed for 2 years and then received venetoclax obinutuzumab for disease progression, but then 2 years later had disease progression again.
We started her on pirtobrutinib, and she's been on that for a couple of months. And thinking through her case, she had originally gotten ibrutinib. This was back in 2019. I wanted to treat her with something differently. That's why, you know, we went with her pirtobrutinib as opposed to acalabrutinib or zanubrutinib. But if she had this much time in between the initial treatment and now, do we think that she would respond to a rechallenge with the BTK inhibitor second generation, especially because she never really failed the ibrutinib, she just couldn't tolerate it. I wanted to try a different approach, so that's why we did the pirtobrutinib.
Any questions for the faculty?
What side effects do you look for managing the toxicities of pirtobrutinib? I'm just curious, where do you see that fitting into the treatment paradigm? I know there's been some early studies and some press releases about, you know, them looking at this earlier in therapy, maybe even in first line. I'm just curious what we've heard about earlier line therapies where we think this is a third generation, maybe a little more effective and also a little more favorable toxicity. So I'm just curious, where do you guys see this being, you know, down the road? Do we see this being incorporated earlier into our management of CLL, maybe taking the place of even acalabrutinib or zanubrutinib?
after pirtobrutinib, where do we go? So if you use that up front, is there any role for any of the other BTKs that are currently available? It's incredible how pirtobrutinib, you know, like I have several patients on it. And initially when I used it, I didn't think it was going to work, but it just works. And so my personal feeling is that frontline approval will change the complete scenario, potentially. I mean, we don't have all the data, but it looks like patients handle that drug very well without a lot of challenges. The question is limited duration treatment versus a pirtobrutinib-based regimen. So that will be the question in a few months. So I'd like to know how she approaches that.
Okay, so the initial questions were really all centered around first-line therapy. And then, you know, now these questions are going to be centered around what do we do in subsequent lines. And before we jump into that, there was a question from the audience. And we see this all the time, and I know you do as well in practice. You have a patient, want a covalent BTKI, and they come in and they have new onset AFib. What do you do then? You change therapy? Do you treat the AFib and understanding the risk with anticoagulation, et cetera, there?
Yeah, I think that's really hard because it depends on what's going on with the AFib. So I've definitely had patients that were taking a first-line BTK inhibitor. You know, if it's 7 or 8 years into it, you're like, okay, we'll just stop the BTK inhibitor, right? But if it's like a year and a half in, you know that the remission's not going to be long. And if the AFib really isn't causing them too much difficulty, like they're not symptomatic, they're taking a beta blocker or whatever, maybe also taking a apixaban and it's going fine, then I think it's fine to continue. But we all have patients where the AFib is really just ruining their life and they're symptomatic and they're in the hospital and they're getting ablations. In those cases, I usually do recommend stopping it in the hopes that that will improve their AFib management. So I think it is a discussion with the patient about how impactful the AFib is on their health.
And have you had patients that you discontinued the BTK, they got their AFib under control and you came back and said, hey, I want to give you another BTK, and they were like, okay with that?
Yes, definitely, especially when you see that that's like the best option for their CLL at that point and the AFib has been okay. I've definitely done that for sure.
Perfect. Yeah. Okay, questions in general. For a patient with CLL with disease progression, say they've been on a BTK inhibitor for 6 years or so, they then receive venetoclax and obinutuzumab, what would be your third-line treatment, I guess, to say in this situation? And, you know, how long they were on first and second line, how does that impact your decision here?
So definitely clinical trials, but pirtobrutinib, I think, is the most effective approved drug here for sure. And if they're younger patients, this is the time when you make sure you explain why they might want a consultation regarding CAR T-cell therapy or to proceed with that. And this is the group, if they're very young, where you talk about getting a consultation regarding donor stem cell transplant. So after resistance to two different targeted classes of targeted agents, you need to have that discussion if people are younger. I mean, if they're in their 90s, I think the discussion is not really, that's, you know. I do think if covalent BTK inhibitors are stopped soon, I have absolutely retreated people with them 6, 7, 8, 9 years later. I've had patients that stopped ibrutinib for like cardiac toxicity or something for good reasons, chose venetoclax-based therapy, years in the future need treatment again, and have picked a more selective BTK inhibitor like AKL or Xanu, and it works great. We can do molecular testing for mutations associated with resistance, BTK and PLC gamma 2 mutations, so I usually do that. There's some retrospective data, and also we've just seen that if the exposure to a covalent BTK inhibitor is short and they are responding well when they discontinue it, you can absolutely reuse that class of drug.
And when you do mutation testing, are you using a standard NGS liquid myeloid panel there?
Yes, we have two panels. We actually have a digital droplet PCR that's highly sensitive specifically for BTK481S that is flow sorted for B cells on the blood or selected for B cells. I think they do it differently depending on the count. And then we have an NGS panel that has a good sensitivity that covers the entire coding region. These are both in-house, but I know that reference lab testing can also be used here.
So for a patient that's double refractory who then receives pirtobrutinib, I think we get back to the question of these are difficult people, and depending on the age, what would you do in this situation? When does allogeneic transplant, when does CAR T step onto the stage?
Yes. So for patients who had significant exposure or treatment to a covalent BTK inhibitor and venetoclax and then are on pirtobrutinib, you need to have a discussion about what their expectations are. Things like BTK degraders can work here. There's investigational therapies that can work. Pirtobrutinib, the median progression-free survival is like a year and a half. So if you think someone's got a more than a year and a half of lifespan, which is basically everybody, this is where you have to have a talk about liso-cel. You know, if that's ineffective, referral to consider donor stem cell transplant, which doesn't have great outcomes, but these are the patients who might die of CLL. I will say that before we had pirtobrutinib, or when we only had it investigationally, and you know, there's some investigational BTK and BCL2 inhibitors that might help, so I don't want to say that there's no hope here. Investigational therapies are quite good in this situation. But the combination of a covalent BTK inhibitor and venetoclax for patients who were or had CLL that was resistant to them as monotherapy actually does work and can get deep remissions. Why? We are not sure. We've published our retrospective data with this. This is an observation from others as well. So if the CLL is resistant to the drugs individually, the combination can still be effective. So for patients who are unfit for cellular therapy, unfit for clinical trials, you can get some activity there.
So what you're saying is in these high-risk people, pirtobrutinib is not going to avoid the need for some other therapy. The median duration in that situation,
right,
after double failure is going to be, you know, 18 to 24 months or...
Yeah, and I didn't get to say this before, but pirtobrutinib seems to be the most tolerable drug that I've ever used. You do see some BTK inhibitor side effects, like a little bit of bruising, but people sometimes think I gave them a placebo, even though it wasn't in a clinical trial, until they see their lymph nodes going down and their blood counts getting better. But... you know, this is where you really need to convince people that if they have a lot of lifespan less, pirtobrutinib's not going to go the distance. And these are people who took a BTK inhibitor, which is easy, venetoclax, which was harder but relatively easy, pirtobrutinib, which was the easiest of all, and it is difficult to convince people that then they need to go do something like CAR-T. But that is the population where clinical trials, CAR-T, referral for a consultation regarding stem cell transplants important. Or you have some people that are reaching the end of their lifespan and they're like, okay, this is fine. But this is really where you need to have that discussion.
And thanks for calling out the really limited toxicity from proto. I think a lot of us love that because it's easy to manage. And so would love to move it frontline, but want to do so, you know, with eyes wide open there. And so understanding the sequencing risk that you may pose.
Yeah, I do want to say that there's a PERTO study. There's a PVO upfront one and PVR phase 3. So using it in a fixed duration combination could limit resistance and really be a way to maybe benefit from that even more in an upfront setting without the resistance concerns.
So as we see folks that may progress through PERTO and we're beginning to have discussions about CAR-T, allogeneic transplant, bispecifics, what are your thoughts on two questions? Number one, what's the role and how you may need to debulk them to get there, right? So obviously you want to avoid Benda and you lose all your T cells, but what would you use for debulking? And then what would be your preferred? Is it, you know, is there a bite that's coming? Is it CAR-T? Is it allo transplant in that space?
Yeah, so I try to get people for CAR-T before doing an allo transplant because I just think, one, the toxicity is less, and two, the data actually looks better. So liso-cel is about a 20% CR rate by itself. That's certainly not good enough. CR is what you need to get the really durable remissions. The study where they added ibrutinib, you got mid-40s CR rate, so that improves it a lot. The problem is people's CLL is resistant to ibrutinib, so you can't really do it there. So most of the time I've used pirtobrutinib. And actually, if you add venetoclax back in, you can get really nice debulking. We'd like to study that as an investigational bridging strategy because I think you'll get deeper remissions. So that is something we'd like to look at in a formal way. A lot of the studies use anti-CD20, but I think in order to get the deeper remission, and remember, lower lymph node size and less disease means better likelihood of a complete remission with CAR-T. For the few patients I've convinced to do this, I've used venetoclax there and continued the BTK inhibitor throughout the process.
Is there ever a place where you would use some debulking cyclophosphamide or something in that space? Let's say a patient had bulky retroperitoneal nodes, 17P, progressed through pirtobrutinib, you want to try to get them to CAR-T, what would be your regimen to get to
Yeah, well, I think the major problem with the chemotherapy is that in deletion 17p or TP53 altered CLL, which is the vast majority of patients who get to this point, they've acquired that, the chemotherapy just doesn't work very well. Right? Like, I had someone that actually didn't fully lymphodeplete with the lymphodepletion chemotherapy. My colleague in cell therapy was like, what is happening? I'm like, well, that's CLL that's just resistant to this stuff. So I don't know that that's going to work as well as some of these other approaches, although I certainly don't think it's a wrong approach if you're just trying to get everything down before the cell therapy.
Perfect. Okay, we got one more case from Dr. Iannucci.
The next case from Dr. Iannucci is a 78-year-old woman.
In 2020, she enrolled in a clinical trial with ibrutinib, with or without pembrolizumab. And she responded wonderfully as far as her CLL, however, had significant, what we believe in retrospect, is IO toxicities with vestibular dysfunction, arthritis, immune-mediated transaminitis. And she was taken off trial and then observed again. So she was observed until 2023. We repeated cytogenetics due to a rising white blood cell count and some B symptoms that she was having, worsening splenomegaly, and she continued to have deletions of 13q, 11q, and now she has a 17p deletion that she did not have initially. She developed progressive cytopenias in late 2024, and we decided on a regimen of obinutuzumab and venetoclax. And so she's done okay. She's kind of struggled through it, but she did complete her therapy. Her white blood cell count is normal. Her flow cytometry is now normal. I did do a bone marrow biopsy on her, and there was no evidence of CLL. And so she is under active surveillance. For right now, she receives monthly IVIG for hypogammaglobulinemia and is overall doing well. So my questions to the faculty about her case is the best regimen for patients. She didn't like the idea of being on Bruton's tyrosine kinase inhibitor forever and ever. She liked the idea at that point of trying to proceed with a treatment that was self-limited.
Yeah, I think it's a great case, and we all see this, right? I mean, plenty of patients who come in and say, I do not want to be, I don't like medicines, I don't want to be on continuous therapy, I'll do something for a bit, but then I'm off. And so how does the disease-free interval duration of response impact your decision there?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. There's actually a survey from the CLL Society showing the vast majority of CLL patients want fixed-duration treatment, although there's a very reasonable minority that actually want continuous treatment. And it's probably the same people that don't like observation, right? So I think for Ven-Obin, I definitely have and do retreat people probably if they got less than a year of benefit after. I certainly wouldn't try it again as a fixed duration strategy. You could probably recapture the response and leave them on it. If it was more than 2 years, I'd feel fairly comfortable repeating it, especially if it wasn't the frontline setting. But I don't know that that's based on any particular data. I think that's interesting to see. The REVENGE or REVENGE study is going on right now to look at retreatment after frontline Ven-Obin. I think that'll be informative. And I would like to see actually studies of a BTK inhibitor, venetoclax here, especially pirtobrutinib, because it looks like the patient described had ibrutinib exposure. I think that would be really exciting. And I think investigational approaches would also be really exciting here, maybe with a bispecific combination or something.
Thanks. So with our last few minutes, can you talk a little bit about sonrotoclax, what its role might be, toxicity versus venetoclax, and what are your thoughts about the degraders? You know, we've seen sort of underwhelming results in, say, PROTAC therapy in the estrogen and prostate androgen space. You expect it to be better here.
Yeah. So in sonrotoclax, I'm really looking forward to the results of Celestial, which is a phase 3 study, because I think that'll get us a better read on what the toxicities are and what you kind of get with that combination versus like a Zanu venetoclax. I think it'll be similar with sonrotoclax. It has the same kind of side effects as you see with BCL2 inhibitors like venetoclax, and we've had some investigational BCL2 inhibitors. But I really think like the phase 1 is insufficient to say there's some huge differentiator for toxicity there. They also have a bunch of different ramp-up schemes, including looking at one, hopefully, that's going to be more convenient for our patients, because that's a huge barrier for my patients wanting to do any BCL-2 inhibitor. And so I think that's kind of where it stands now. I look forward to hearing more about that. And then what was the last thing that you asked me? I was excited to answer.
Degraders and then the toxicities of, let's say, the sonrotoclax, or what we might expect from a differential there.
Yeah, I don't know for sonrotoclax that there's a differentiator yet, but when we have like very large scale data, I think there probably will be. So degraders. I was excited to talk about that. These are very effective in CLL. So while it might have been disappointing in some other areas, we do see good outcomes in CLL, probably because we've shown in CLL that continuing to hit BTK with a different or better strategy works, right? So like covalent BTK inhibitor stops working, non-covalent works great, right? So then degrader has been working after there, and that slide I had, it looks like, okay, it works all right, but that's actually a hugely refractory patient population. So you're seeing these degraders work in patients that have had like all the standard treatments and they're still getting a benefit. So I think those are really, really going to be exciting to use and help a lot of patients.
That's great. So last question. So when you think about sequencing these things, would you be using mutational, you know, studies to look and say, well, I'll start with covalent and non-covalent, then I'll get to the degrader based on what that might look like?
That's a great question. Like mutations in BTK being acquired. Yes, I think we might get there. I think that's going to be really exciting, but I think we've got a ways to go to be able to put together a coherent pathway for that. And remember, BTK mutations are never present before treatment with a BTK inhibitor. So you'd have to do that kind of serially. And I think that'd be a great approach. I think we're not quite there yet.
We're seeing that parallel in other disease states, right? ESR1, et cetera. So it's a bit of we selected out based on our treatments. Okay, well, thank you so much. I really appreciate the time, Dr. Rogers.